Where millions of people once culled weeds with sharpened hoes, a few farmers can now cull millions of weeds in the comfort of air-conditioned tractors. The Monsanto Corporation, with its Roundup herbicides and Roundup Ready crops, has made it a lot easier for farmers to grow food. But some say there is a cost to the technology. Some say Monsanto's herbicidal technology has spawned a new pathogen that causes spontaneous abortion rates of 20 to 45% in the animals that feed upon those crops. If true, we ask, what will the Monsanto bug do to us?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 739th edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Milan who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Nikki James on the boards. Hello, Nikki.
Good morning.
Hey, studio guest Chuck Molnar. Hello, Chuck.
Good morning.
Folks, I was a teenage herbicide, like many of you out there. I spent many of my summer days of my youth hoeing weeds for farmers in Montana's Yellowstone River Valley. It was hot, sweaty work, but vitally important. You see, left unchecked, those weeds would have taken the farmers' sunshine, water, and nutrients, and left farmers without any crops for their winters. For young teens with big dreams, weddings, or weedings at least, is never much fun. You imagine what it's like out there hoeing away under that hot sun. I remember looking up to the passenger jets flying over at 35,000 feet and calling up to them, "Take me away!" Finally, one did. You know, the Monsanto Corporation has freed millions from the toil of hoeing weeds in hot summer sunshine. Monsanto's glyphosate-based herbicide, which travels under the trade name Roundup, and its Roundup-ready genetically engineered crops make it possible for one farmer to kill millions of weeds while sitting in the cool of an air-conditioned tractor. Consequently, Monsanto's herbicidal technologies are now used in 85 to 90% of the nation's corn and soybean crops. And when Monsanto's Roundup Ready alfalfa spreads across the land, America will literally become drenched in glyphosate, and its young will be freed to pursue more productive interests, like hanging around the street corner in hooded sweatshirts. But wait, some say there is a cost to this herbicidal technology. In a warning letter to USDA Secretary Tom Vilsack, plant pathologist Dr. Don Huber pointed to the existence of a newly discovered pathogen that he claims is causing spontaneous abortion rates of 20 to 45% in the animal populations that feed on genetically engineered crops. If this observation is true, we ask, what will a Monsanto bug do to us? Well, here to help us dig for an answer, we have Dr. Huber himself, who is Professor Emeritus at Purdue University. Dr. Huber, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thank you, Michael. It's an honor to be here.
Pleasure to have you aboard. Let's start with some basics. What on earth is a plant pathologist? Are you there?
Yes. I missed that question. I'm sorry.
Okay, what is a plant pathologist?
Plant pathologist is a scientist that studies plant diseases and their control. I'm also spent a lot of my time with soil-borne diseases, so in this area we also have to have a very thorough understanding of soil microbiology and ecological principles that are involved in disease control and their epidemiology and interactions.
Well, I have to tell you, Dr. Huber, when I put out the notice that I was going to be interviewing you on this new bug, I heard from a whole bunch of plant pathologists, and I didn't realize there were so many of them in the United States. So this should be fun. Purdue University, people who do not know about Purdue probably do not know that it's one of the nation's premier agriculture research institutions, right?
Yes, it is. Very excellent institution, very excellent place to research and work because we have the cooperative interaction between many other disciplines in soils, agronomy, horticulture, and ecology, as well as our own colleagues in plant pathology and microbiology.
Kind of like the center of web of research. But you're also a retired colonel in the U.S. military, and as such, you were in research and development, or research at least at various toxins that have could be used as a threat to the United States, correct?
Yes. A lot of that involvement was on defensive measures against threat pathogens, anticipation of new problems, new diseases that could be introduced or might be overtly used against us, because in agriculture, it's the basic infrastructure for our society. If you don't have food to eat, you don't work, you don't have the health and stamina that you need to keep a society functional.
You know, I have having done this radio show for 739 Saturdays, I came up with a few laws of the food chain. And law number one is, agriculture is the foundation upon which we build all our sandcastles. No agriculture, no sandcastles. I guess you just kind of renewed that observation. Dr. Huber, we always ask our guests, who pays your way? So with respect to the research you've been doing on this pathogen, who's been paying your way to do this research?
Most of my research has been done early on. I spent the last 15 years at Purdue looking at various ways to remediate the residual effects of glyphosate and its impact on nutrient availability and nutrient relationships, as those are influenced by soil microorganisms, and trying to develop those techniques so that we could really optimize the technology by minimizing some of the downsides that it has for us.
So you have a lot of research into the impact of glyphosate on plants and the environment. Now, in January, you sent a rather startling letter to USDA Secretary Tom Vilsack warning of the impact of a new pathogen on the nation's food chain. Would you tell us a little bit about what you put in the letter to Vilsack?
Well, that was to be a private letter to start with, and confidential because of the interactions. The purpose of the letter was to make Secretary Vilsack aware of the growing problem. It had first been addressed by the American Cattlemen's Association in testimony to the Senate Agriculture Committee in 2002, where they reported that there were two serious concerns that they had that were growing concerns. One was the high rate of infertility and reproductive failure in animals that they indicated in 2002 that was approaching 10 to 11% of their producers. The other concern that they had of unknown cause or unknown etiology was the fact that their carcasses for the cattle when they went to market were being downgraded because they appeared to be very old animals rather than the young animals that were being marketed.
Wow.
Since then,
we're talking premature aging.
Yes, very, very definite. If you look at those carcasses, the tallow is very, very characteristic of what you would find with an animal that might be 8 or 10 or even 12 years old compared to a 2-year-old prime animal going in for our food chain. So those two concerns were raised. We've had a number of veterinarians that have worked very hard to keep their dairy and pig producers in business, and many of them have gone out of business because of reproductive failure and the inability to keep replacement animals coming. In a dairy, if you don't have replacement animals, or if you can't get a heifer bread, you don't have milk production very long. And we're seeing that in some of those situations that are documented that the infertility level will be 16%. But then even those that are confirmed as being having conceived will have then a later spontaneous abortion or a miscarriage later on in the pregnancy of as high as anywhere from 25. We have one situation as high as 55%.
Wow. Doctor, can you hold that? We're going to come back. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson. We're talking about the impact of glyphosate herbicide on our food chain. What on earth will it do to us? We're with Dr. Don Huber, Professor Emeritus Plant Pathology, Purdue University. Michael Olson, we will be right back. Do stay tuned.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of Metro Farm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. Metro Farm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. Metro Farm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. Metro Farm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of Metro Farm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Michael Olson here. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. I am Michael Olson, your host. Today we're talking with Dr. Don Huber, Professor Emeritus, Purdue University, plant pathologist. We're talking about herbicides. You know that there are about 185 million pounds of herbicides dumped on America each year, and that's about enough for two-thirds of a pound for each and every one of us. And this stuff has made farming a lot easier because you and I don't have to go out in the field and weeds and with a hoe and weed the weeds. But some say there is a cost to that, and that's what we're talking about with Professor Huber today. Professor Huber, how exactly does this technology work? It seems to me like there's two parts to it. There's the herbicide itself, which is a glyphosate-based blend of different things, and then there's the genetically modified crops that have been re-engineered to accept the herbicide without dying. So how does the herbicide itself work in layman's terms?
Well, the herbicide works by tying up or immobilizing a very critical micronutrient that regulates the enzyme in plant defense mechanisms. So that by tying up this particular nutrient, and that would be manganese, although glyphosate is a very broad spectrum chelator, we call it, or it ties on to most positively charged mineral nutrients and will immobilize them so that they're not available for specific plant functions.
Mm-hmm.
By doing that, then it shuts down those defense mechanisms and makes the plants very susceptible to soil-borne organisms that are present in essentially all of our soil. So what it essentially does, if we use kind of a crude analogy, is it gives the plants or the weeds a bad case of AIDS. And that's why with glyphosate, it's a very powerful tool for us in agriculture because it essentially rendered all plants susceptible to these organisms so that they readily died from infection.
Wow.
When the gene was inserted,
this is the other side of the technology, the genetically engineered crops, then.
Yes. Before the genetically engineered crops, you couldn't put it directly on the crop because it would also kill the plant.
Right.
The crop plant. So by inserting a gene that provided another enzyme system that wasn't sensitive to glyphosate. It made it possible then to apply the herbicide pretty much whenever you wanted it, made it a very simple weed control program because you could apply it directly to the plant. That made took away a lot of decisions that were otherwise required. And that would be, you know, normally have to be factored into your time schedule and everything.
Sure.
But because you could apply it directly to the plant. One thing that most people don't realize is that this technology doesn't do anything for the glyphosate that's being applied to the plant. All it does is insert an alternative physiological mechanism to permit direct application of that toxic material or chelating material directly on the plant. And that doesn't kill the plant. It does have some effects there because there isn't anything in the technology, again, that does anything to the glyphosate. It only makes it possible for the plant to survive the pathogens that would normally be fatal to the plant.
Right. So with these two technologies, we've really changed the face of agriculture. No longer do young people like I once was have to go out and hoe weeds. You just spray on the herbicide, and it kills all the weeds except those that have been, those plants that have been re-engineered not to die. So it's
correct.
Really simplified the whole process of weed control, correct?
It's been a very powerful technology for us to use to cover more acres, and it's been an economical program in most situations to minimize a lot of those management decisions that were always subject to weather and other factors.
But then along comes your secret letter to Tom Vilsack. And this is really what you say in this letter is really some very astounding things that the use of this herbicide and the consumption of these crops by animals is causing spontaneous abortion rates of 20 to 55%, and that farmers are going out of business, and some crops are dying prematurely in the fields, and how did you go about pursuing what was wrong here?
Well, part of the purpose of that letter was to request their assistance. Essentially, was to point out to the secretary that what the American Cattlemen's Association had testified of to the Senate Agriculture Committee in 2002, that causal organism had been identified, but we needed research, needed their cooperation and resources to really do the research that was involved and required from an epidemiological standpoint to gain further information on this organism.
Now, with respect to this bug, like I said, I had a lot of plant pathologists tuning in with me and asking, you know, expressing a lot of skepticism with respect to what's going on here, because the implications of this assertion are so huge. So let me ask you a couple of real basic questions. Have you completed the Cox postulates with respect to this pathogen?
The veterinarians have completed that. For plants, what we have is the association of the organism. We're not sure whether it's just the synergy between our disease plants and those specific organisms that favor this new organism, or whether it's actually a cause-effect relationship there.
Mm-hmm.
It may be a synergy. Certainly our plant pathogens and diseases have changed with the introduction of glyphosate. We see much more severe, much more intense disease. And one of the things that we see for diseases like sudden death syndrome that we've never been able to fully document what all of the causes of the symptoms are, that we find this organism present both in the mycelium of the fungus and the growth of the fungus that we associate with sudden death syndrome, and also throughout the tissues where the fungus stays in the root system. In fact, it was this area that the veterinarians traced the source of animal infection to the soybean meal. And then since then, we find it in high populations in Gauss's wilt-infected corn or in distiller's protein, a lot of those feed sources. But the organism has been grown in culture.
So you did grow it in culture.
A very slow grower, grows much better with another organism, a yeast or fungus or bacterium. They seem to be very compatible.
And you have and you have demonstrated that it actually kills a fertilized chicken egg.
Yes, if infected early in 24 to 48 hours, it will kill the embryo.
Wow.
Later on, it becomes more resistant to this organism, but early on it does do that. And in every case of when you look at the fetal or placental tissues of those miscarried tissues in animals, you find this organism.
Folks, phone numbers today, 831-713-4277, 831-713-4277. We will go to the phones with you and Dr. Don Huber on the Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We will be right back. Well, folks, if it's true, this Monsanto bug, what will it do for us? You know, we're putting about 185 million pounds of herbicides onto our land every year. It's really how we do things now. It's how we grow our crops. It's become such a part of how we do things that it just is. So Dr. Don Huber and others have come up with a notion that the impact of this, all of this herbicide and these genetically engineered crops has spawned the discovery, at least, of a new pathogen that is causing spontaneous abortions in 20 to 45 to 55% of the animal populations eating the genetically engineered food. It's causing spontaneous death in some of the crops. And I've seen pictures of croplands where entire acreage is poof, gone. So we're looking at this situation and wondering if it is true, if there really is this pathogen, what impact would it have on us? And that's the subject of the... So let's ask Dr. Don Huber. What about us, doctor?
Well, we don't know for sure. What we do know is that this organism is associated with reproductive failure in cattle and dairy, pigs, goats, horses, sheep, and poultry. That's an extremely broad spectrum of activity for any organism, but one that wouldn't take too much of a change or a jump to certainly extend that host range even further. It's just that that research isn't available at this time, and the focus has been more on the animal production and making sure that we have replacement animals to maintain the viability of our agricultural industry.
And we see this new bug throughout the heartland. It's been discovered in 9 states.
Yes. Again, those are where it's been identified, and those in the reproductive failure where we've been able to rule out all other known causes of those problems.
Well, we're going to try going to the phones right now. We're going to be talking with Steve Savage, who's tuning in from San Diego. Steve, welcome to the Food Chain.
Hi, thank you.
And you have a question or comment for Dr. Savage, or for Dr. Huber here?
Yeah, hi, Dr. Huber.
You're a plant pathologist as well, right, Steve?
Yeah, okay. I'm a pathologist. And
this is the Plant Pathologist Show.
There really aren't that many plant pathologists in the world. But anyway, Don, one of the hallmarks of science is that when you find something, you publish it, you find other researchers who are able to replicate results, that sort of thing. Who would I talk to that would be able to say, yes, I have replicated Don Huber's results?
This actually on the organism is not my direct results. My results have been with the plant, increasing plant disease and susceptibility. And those areas, the nutrient disease, herbicide interactions. The research on a new organism is with the veterinarians and veterinary pathologists, and they have preferred not to have that public. They have preferred not to have that published until the sequencing is completed. And that's just because it creates more concerns. That was one of the reasons for my letter to Secretary Vilsack, asking that it be confidential and private, soliciting those resources that are required. As you know, it's about a $45,000 process just to do the sequencing. That's after you have the organism cultured and produced. And so the epidemiological work and a lot of that research has gone on, the XRF, vein scans, and all of that research. But until the sequencing is completed, you really don't know what to call it. And so
Don,
that's why it isn't published. It will be, and it will be peer-reviewed.
Let me ask you something, Dr. Huber. Why did the letter become public?
I don't know who leaked that. Some of my USDA colleagues indicated that the letter was distributed to the soybean board and to the commodity groups and a number of other commercial entities even before they saw it. And they've speculated that it may be someone on one of the boards that leaked the letter. I really don't know who leaked it or why in that process. It certainly complicated my life considerably.
You became famous.
Well, I was soliciting help and their cooperation because they do have the resources. This appears to answer the concerns that the American Cattlemen Association and others have raised since 2002. And we needed additional resources to move it along quickly. At the time, the Secretary was considering additional deregulation of Roundup Ready crops and
alfalfa.
Alfalfa and sugar beets.
Sugar beets.
Both of those are feed crops for our animals. The sugar beet pulp, very important source of feed for our dairies especially. And if what we see happening with Goss's wilt on corn, where just the application of a surfactant or glyphosate to the corn nullifies that genetic resistance to the clavibacter organism.
We're going to have to hold the rest of it, Doctor. We have to take a quick break. Folks, right back. Phone numbers today, 831-713-4277. We have Steve on the line from San Diego, Paul from the University of Tennessee, and you. Do stay tuned. Welcome back. This is the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson here. Today we're talking with Dr. Don Huber, Professor Emeritus, Purdue University, plant pathologist. We're talking about a possible new pathogen discovered from the use of herbicides, especially glyphosate-based things like Roundup, and the consumption of the Roundup-ready genetically engineered crops by our animals, and what impact that's having on our food chain. And Dr. Huber says that it appears to be having a huge impact with 20 to 45% spontaneous abortion rates in the populations of animals that eat that genetically engineered food. And so, my goodness, that's quite profound. Steve Savage, plant pathologist from San Diego, what do you think about this whole notion?
Well, you know, it's almost hard to know where to start. I mean, Don described the mechanism of glyphosate resistance wrong. He isn't willing to tell us any other scientists that can confirm anything he's talking about. He makes allegations about diseases like sudden death syndrome.
So you don't believe any of this at all?
Sudden death soybean has syndrome in soybeans that goes back a long, long time before glyphosate-resistant crops. No, I think there's, if you go into the details, he's described this pathogen as some sort of fungal-like organism that's the size of viruses. You go through that list, and any reasonable scientist is going to say, man, it would take a hell of a lot of information and confirmation by other scientists for me to even begin to believe this.
Well, given the impact of the extent to which we use this stuff.
Think about this. If the impact was what you've described over and over again on your show, wouldn't you expect that there would be huge impacts on meat and milk supplies and that there would be a huge difference between the countries whether they did or didn't use these? I mean,
I would expect so, yeah.
With nobody sort of seeing this in the grocery store.
Well, that's a great question, and we'll ask Dr. Huber. Thank you so much for the call, Steve. Really appreciate it. Dr. Huber, there seems to be
Michael.
Yeah, go ahead.
I have a minute just to respond.
Steve asked why
this hasn't been published in peer-reviewed journals, and I'd like to respond.
Please do.
The interactions with the glyphosate, the nutrient immobilization, and the increased disease is very well documented in many, many scientific peer-reviewed papers. The thing that hasn't been established for sure is the cause-effect relationship with this new organism, but as far as the peer-reviewed science papers that are out there for review and scrutiny, as they have already been scrutinized through the peer review process, those are readily available as far as the impact of glyphosate and its residual effects on soil organisms and nutrient availability and increased disease. So that when you have any new organism or new entity to science, as this appears to be, that it takes some time and it takes resources. And that was my request to the secretary, so that we could really have those resources. What we have are associations, and
So you really
know that those are the conditions that predispose the high populations of this organism in the food and the feed that are then associated with the documented effect of this organism on reproductive failure.
Okay, so let's try Paul Vincelli, who is with the University of Tennessee. Paul, welcome to the Food Chain.
Well, thank you, Michael. Thanks for taking my call. Let me just point out University of Kentucky. Thanks.
Oh, okay.
And thanks again for taking my call.
Nikki's from the University of Idaho, so we'll blame it on her. Go ahead.
Okay, that's fine.
I had a chance to visit with you last week in Hawaii.
Yes, that's right. And Dr. Huber, I have a lot of respect for Dr. Huber's long career. It is the claims on the microfungus, or the new organism, that I'd really like to focus
on. Fire away.
And Carl Sagan once wrote, extraordinary claims require extraordinary proof. And in this case, we have extraordinary claims, but there is no publicly available information that would even qualify as ordinary proof. So the scientific community, at least the circles that I run in, is very skeptical about these very unusual claims, especially in the absence of proof.
What do you say about the notion that Professor Huber was trying to say that we should get proof?
Well, I mean, think
doesn't that make sense?
It's true. Yes, it absolutely does, and I think the work should be pursued. There's one option is to write a proposal like every other scientist. If the evidence is sufficient at this point to be talking about it publicly, then it would seem to be it would seem to have a good case for funding through a competitive process. That's what scientists do. We make the case for funding our projects. And if there isn't sufficient evidence to write a proposal, then we shouldn't be talking about
it. Let me ask you this. You know, one of the things that you and I talked about, Paul, was the danger of science being subverted by political processes.
Sure.
And to me, it's one of the most frightening things in the world when you know, the science of something can be manipulated by economic interests bringing weight to bear against the government. Mm-hmm. Could that be a situation that we're looking at? I mean, you think about the amount of money that's invested in the glyphosate world.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know if there's any way I could reassure your listeners about that. I know in my case, and at least the people I'm close to in the plant pathology world, I don't represent Monsanto. I have no interest in Monsanto. I'm calling to defend the scientific method, and I have
amen to that.
Yeah, I believe that the principles of the scientific method work very well, and it's a messy process. There's a lot of backbiting and clawing to get things published because it's hard work to get past rigorous scientific review. But until that's happened, and that hasn't happened in this case, the new organism claims have not been published in a peer-reviewed scientific journal. And until they are, we don't have anything to go on. We don't have anything to evaluate.
Okay, Professor Huber, really quickly.
Yes, Paul, you're very much aware of the process of getting grants and the time frame and the need to meet the specific RFI requirements for the granting agency. And you're also aware that a year and a half ago, I had solicited assistance from colleagues and those who were...
Professor Huber, we have to take a quick break. Please hold that. We will be right back. Why no research? Do stay tuned. Well, hey, this from Professor Don Huber's presentation to the FDA. Abundant evidence exists of suppression of scientific research into potential problems associated with genetically engineered crops, and there is a climate of ongoing hostility towards serious efforts to investigate potential deleterious effects of current agricultural practices. Suppression of free scientific inquiry has been repeatedly documented, including a cautionary letter from 26 university entomologists who wrote anonymously to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency out of fear of retaliation and likely harm to their careers. Reports of recent efforts to stifle open research are now surfacing at major land-grant universities in association with the recent findings related to glyphosate and the new organism. Professor Huber, do you think that you're going to be able to pry loose some open consideration of this subject by standing up and talking about it like you are?
Yes. Yes, that's occurring. As Paul said, we should get the funding, write the grants. We've done that. I had the head of a representative from one of our major commodity groups tell me point blank that they were committed to an expanding use of genetic engineering, and they would not ever consider funding this type of research. Now, there are a growing number of peer-reviewed
Do you think that those commercial interests would be putting pressure on the federal government to not study this subject?
Well, politics doesn't work in a vacuum. But what I can tell you in response to Dr. Vincelli's request that we get it out in a peer-reviewed journal is that's a double standard. We ask for that for anything new in science, and we expect it. But I know of no peer-reviewed scientific journal that will establish the safety of glyphosate, but there's a growing number that shows severe kidney, toxicology, endocrine hormone, birth defects at levels and our food supply that are more than 200 times lower
than permitted in our food supply. Yet I see no peer-reviewed science that tells me of the safety. I also see many peer-reviewed scientific articles supporting the nutrient disease herbicide interaction that appears to predispose to this new organism that we're trying to get the research on.
Where do we go from here, Doctor?
Our research is continuing. The real limiting factor right now is identifying what this entity is. Since it's new to science, it doesn't really give us a lot to fall back on as far as prior history.
And there
and
it is.
We're kind of waiting for the sequence data to give us that genetic information that then we can figure out what kind of a pigeonhole in the taxonomic scheme of things that it would fit. In the meantime, it's critical that we have the research.
And we're out of time right here, but folks,
okay.
Thank you for tuning in. Professor Emeritus Dr. Don Huber, thank you for joining us. Thank you all for tuning in. Sorry I couldn't get to all the phone calls. Completely swamped, out of time. Go to the forums at metrofarm.com and tell us what you think. Thank you all for tuning in.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live. We'll be right back.